Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
And gentlemen, I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. I'm here with my co-host, Alfred Adisk, to bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for Friday, June 13th, 2014. Good afternoon, Al.
Hi, Melody.
Well, it seems the big solar event that happened a few days ago that was supposed to impact the communications here on Earth, there's folks who were thinking it would send a big shockwave this Friday, and that was actually, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, was supposed to have caused, the solar events caused brief blackouts in high-frequency communications when they struck first Tuesday morning, but I guess we're okay this Friday the 13th, Al.
So far. Friday the 13th isn't over until midnight, you understand, Melody. So there's still time for a couple of surprises. I'm not sure what happened
surprise,
there.
Surprise! Surprise!
Yeah. All right.
Gotcha.
You did. You got me on that one.
And it was a full moon last night, too. So you folks, stay home, be safe, and don't let those solar flares and the full moons take you to another level. And gold went to a little bit different level today. We have gold up $4.40 at $12.78. We have silver up 19 at $19.82. Platinum, again, we had the big drops yesterday. Not so bad today. Less than 1%, down $11. At $14.37, along with palladium down 10 at $8.17. You also had the USDX trading stronger, 0.03 at 80.61. And a lot of these numbers are sort of expected after yesterday's moves and news. And crude oil just up slightly, 106.86. And the paper markets today, kind of a lackluster day. The stocks have ended lower for the week. And, of course, all focus is on the conflict in Iraq. And you had the Dow fall. Oh, I don't know if this is correct because it shows at one point, it shows that the Dow fell almost 1%, but yet the numbers are showing only 0.25%. But 16,775 is the number I have now. The NASDAQ up 13 at 43.10, and the S&P up 6 at 19.36. Some of the European markets, they took a little bit of a hit today. And, of course, all in relationship, as they say, to the Iraq. But there's other things going on over there in Europe. Again, they're talking about raising rates. So interesting, but we'll talk after the 10-year yield today, up 0.02 at 2.60%. So coming out of London now, the pound jumped to a near 5-year high.
Relative to the dollar?
Relative to the dollar, as the Bank of England hints rates may rise sooner than expected. And so it's interesting when they come out and are thinking about raising rates. The last time the pound traded above 170 was in August of 2009, and it's just trading slightly below that today at 169.60. So they hinted at the annual banquet of bankers. You got to laugh. What a world we live in. I mean, it's just, you know, you talk
about it. Did they hold it in Bangladesh?
The Bank of England is not pre-committed and would make its decisions according to incoming economic data. But, I know.
Yeah.
I hear you.
They don't know what they're doing.
No.
They don't know what they have. It'll depend on.
But they talk about the strength in the economy and the unemployment dropping and, you know, the same old silvery skies that we hear over here, so. Interesting. GM today came out. They have four new recalls, four new ones, bringing this year. So they've had a total of 38 recalls. It totals has recalled about 14.4 million cars, trucks, and SUVs.
Probably shouldn't even take one off the lot when you buy it yet. I just leave it there, and then it can be repaired without transportation cost.
There's another 2 million, and just if you add in all of North America, so you're looking at 16.5 million vehicles. And so I think those are incredible numbers, but the latest.
I'm sure General Motors thinks the same thing.
Huh.
I mean, they're devastating, really. And there's someone in charge of quality control who's not in charge anymore. Somebody's got to be fired over this. This is a systemic problem. And
well, the last recall was the Chevy Camaro, so from 2010 to 2014.
Yes.
Do you take chia powder?
I actually have some chia seed around here. I don't have chia powder, but I have some chia seed that I bought lately. I can't say that I'm particularly impressed by it, but why do you ask?
Well, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention came out and issued a warning. The CDC issued a warning to consumers who may eat chia powder from the ground-dried chia seeds. Some of the recalled brands are Organic Traditions, Green Smoothie Girl, Navitas, Naturals, and Wilma Sonoma. They have found salmonella outbreak. That is
salmonella. All I hear is salmonella.
12 states from New York to California were sickened, and it was linked to the chia powder. So for those of you who do use that, be careful. Check your brands and throw it away and go get something else.
Or maybe you might want to pass it on to your ex-spouse. You know, that's just a possibility.
Not a Christian thing to do.
Probably not the Christian thing to do, but there's something about divorce court that takes the Christianity out. It either compels you to become a Christian or it really challenges your faith.
Well, you know, Al, you're not the only divorced person out there. I'm a divorced person, and you have to move on.
Well,
yeah.
I have no problem with moving on, but moving on doesn't necessarily mean that you can't joke about it from time to time.
But so that's all the updated news I have today. Prices on coins are stable. We still run the great specials on the 275 over spot for Silver Eagles and large boxes, shipping, and you get a free Silver Eagle with orders. We're going to continue that through. I mean, people love it. We've been getting a lot of new clients, and not only because we got great prices and great shipping, but we do go the extra step here at Discount Gold and Silver. Oh, we were talking now about Iraq.
Yep.
In the news.
Got one here from New York Times. Kurdish fighters take out key city as militants advance on Baghdad. And this is just interesting as background information. Kurdish forces exploited the mayhem convulsing Iraq on Thursday to seize complete control of the strategic northern city of Kirkuk as government troops fled in the face of advancing Sunni militants. The insurgents pressed their advance southward toward Baghdad, warned officials of occupied Mosul to renounce allegiance to the central government, and threatened to destroy religious shrines sacred to Shiites. Now, the reason this is interesting to me is they talk about in this first paragraph, two sentences, they got the Kurds, they've got the Sunnis, and they've got the Shiites. So we have Sunnis and Shiites and Kurds, oh my. Sunnis and Shiites and Kurds, oh my. And that's what's going on. We talked a little about it yesterday. You got three different groups of people that are living in the same area, and they don't much like each other. And they've been placed under, Iraq is an artificial nation. It's been carved by colonial powers, and there's an element of affirmative action here. Our government thought it could wrest power from Saddam Hussein and the Sunni minority. The Sunnis were running the show with Saddam Hussein, ran Saddam Hussein out, gave the folks democracy. The Shiite majority is now ruling. However, the Sunnis are coming back and kicking bun. And our government really thought that they could give the Middle East democracy. Right? And they thought this will work out and everyone, we will all vote and sing Kumbaya. But the truth of the matter is you can't give democracy to a truly religious people. They are incompatible. Democracy and a true faith in God are incompatible. And the reason is because democracy presumes that we the people can just sit around and vote for anything we want without regard to God's law. Democracy is all about doing anything. We do whatever we want. I don't care. You want homosexuality, vote for it. All right? You want child molestation or child sex, vote for it. It's okay. In democracy, anything goes. Whatever the majority says goes. And any people who are truly religious will not embrace democracy. They can't, because inevitably it becomes a means for ungodly people to seize control and pass laws that the godly can't tolerate. So when we think we're going to give these people democracy, that was foolishness, it was insanity, it was short-sighted, it was stupid. So unlike the Americans, we talk about our faith, but we don't have a clue to how faith and politics intermix. The Muslims are serious about their faith. Not all of them, but a lot of them really, really believe. They understand that democracy is anathema to God's law and therefore blasphemy to God. Therefore, the Muslims will never accept a democracy and they will never sing Kumbaya. As long as they believe in the Muslim faith, they will fight either until all of them or all of their enemies are dead. They are engaged in holy war. We're witnessing right now, we're looking at something in Iraq that looks like a civil war in a sense, but we've got three sides to it. But more than that, we're really looking at a holy war between the Sunni Muslims and the Shiite Muslims. The Kurds, not wanting to miss the fun, are also fighting, but they may be motivated more by politics than faith. I doubt that the Sunnis and the Kurds have any love for each other, but both share a common contempt for the majority Shiites. What fun, huh? These Muslims really know how to party. But if America is smart, we'll let them fight until at least one of the major combatants, are all dead or at least exhausted. This is holy war. You got to be crazy to get in the middle of this, right? No compromise, no quarter. They fight until one side or the other is dead. Here's another article from the New York Times. U.S. scrambles to help Iraq fight off militants as Baghdad is threatened. Washington, the White House, confronted by an unexpected crisis on the battlefield it thought it had left behind, scrambled to reassure Iraq that it would help its beleaguered army fend off militants who have overrun much of the country and now threaten Baghdad. recognizing that what one official described as an urgent emergency situation, President Obama and his aides moved on multiple fronts. A senior official said that the president was actively considering American airstrikes against the militant groups. Well, boy, that's impressive, isn't it? The president is actually considering things. That's what we're doing right now. We're considering. Boy, I bet that sends tremors of fear in the spine and down the spines of the militants over there in Iraq. Watch out! Obama is considering. In his only public comments on Iraq, President Obama said national security staff was meeting around the clock. So what? They continue and they say, but the frenzy of activity has yet to produce a tangible American response. And there's the point to this. Attesting to how swiftly this crisis has erupted and how it's left the stunned White House groping for a response. In part, we can't do anything because we're broke. We can't get involved in this stuff. But more to the point, at least in this instance, they talk about how this problem in Iraq has sprung up suddenly, unexpectedly. No one saw it coming. The White House has left a stunned White House groping for a response. What this means is this is the evidence of a massive intelligence failure. If our intelligence agencies had seen this problem coming, our government might have been able to prevent the problem, or at least deal with it rather than simply gape. Perhaps if the NSA spent as much time spying on Iraq as it spent on spying on Americans, our government would not have been so stunned and might have had some plan to deal with this Iraqi civil war. Apparently, President Obama agrees because early today he announced that in the New York Times, New York Times reported it. Obama, that's the headline, no combat troops in Iraq, we can't do it for them. President Obama said today, a couple hours ago, that the U.S. will not send troops into Iraq to fend off a burgeoning Islamic insurgency, and stressed it is now time for the Iraqis, and actually means the Shiites, the majority, to take full responsibility for their own security. So I would say President Obama is exercising, I mean, hooray. He's doing the intelligent thing. This is a mess that you're crazy to get yourself involved in. The Shiites want to kill the Sunnis. And they don't want to kill them a little bit. They want to kill them a lot. And the Sunnis, they want to kill the Shiites. And they are equally determined and fanatical. And as far as I'm concerned, let them have their fight. All right? Smartest thing the West can do is stay out. Let them go. After that, then we'll see what happens. After the whole thing is collapsed, then people can go back in and perhaps rebuild oil fields or whatever, pipelines, and corporations can perhaps begin to make money again. But in the meantime, you're not going to stop this. So why try?
And you know what? It's really sad because, you know, we talked about this yesterday. You have the same thing in Libya with Gaddafi. I mean, they were dictators, but they could manage the people.
Yeah, but Gaddafi was actually very popular with his
people. He was. But he was able to keep things in control.
I understand.
Now they're murdering Christians and everything else, and the U.S. is, you can always point it to where the U.S. is always in there stirring it up. And in the same way with Iraq. I mean, we don't know where Iraq would be today if Saddam.
What's the common denominator between Libya and Iraq? The wars in Libya and Iraq. What's the common denominator, Melody?
There's two. There's oil and there's the dollar.
When we come back, we're going to take our break for some commercial announcements, and we will talk about common denominators when we come back. I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cederstrom. Please stay tuned. Financial Survive. We'll be back in a couple moments.
make the aspirin mistake. Aspirin was discovered by mistake during World War II and suppresses your immune system and prevents blood clotting. Don't expose your body to risk when you can use a natural inflammation and pain reliever called Extra Strength Pain Relief by Apothecary Herbs. Discover the power this formula has with Salicin to enter the system in 60 seconds to work hard and relieve pain for 12 hours. Whether it's arthritis, sports injury, or flu, you can relieve aches, pain, and swelling with our Extra Strength Pain Relief formula. Call Apothecary Herbs now, toll-free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis, here on Financial Survival with Melody Cederstrom. We're going to talk about, briefly, we're going to talk about the comparison, the common denominator between Iraq and Libya. But first, do you have a special for these folks, Melody, or anything they need to know about?
Well, we do have a caller online, so we can bring that up a little after the break. So let's get
Common denominators, and we'll finish that off right now. It won't take long.
Go ahead. Okay? Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
What are the common denominators between the invasion in Iraq and the attack where we participated, at least, in destroying the Libyan government? And the common denominators are one. Iraq, Saddam Hussein in Iraq, threatened to start selling their crude oil for euros rather than dollars. And in doing so, they threatened the dollar's hegemony as the world reserve currency and the world's only petrol currency. The world up until, since 1971 or thereabouts, the early 70s, if you wanted to buy crude oil on the international market, you had to have dollars. This created a demand for paper fiat dollars, which were intrinsically worthless, and the demand effectively gave them value after we went completely off the gold standard. If we hadn't had petrodollars, the dollar would have been worthless and would have been seen to be worthless back in the 70s, and who knows what would have happened after that. Right? But by linking it to petroleum, they gave the dollar apparent value. Now, when Saddam Hussein threatened to sell and then began to sell Iraqi crude in 2000 for euros rather than dollars, he threatened the dollar's power, and we invaded in 2003. We had weapons of mass destruction and other cock and bull stories, but the reason is because Saddam Hussein threatened the almighty dollar. Libya, a few years ago, Muammar Gaddafi was working to create a pan-African currency that would be backed by gold. All the nations of Africa would, in theory, sign up for this currency, and it would be backed by gold, and it would probably have sparked an economic renaissance for Africa. He challenged the monetary system of the world, which is paper and fiat and digital, and the result was he was invaded, and Libya's economy and the nation was blown up, and now they're living in a certain amount of confusion and chaos, and Muammar Gaddafi, of course, is dead as a result. The point, it indicates, illustrates that if you want to get into real trouble, mess with the money system. Go ahead, make an incredible attempt to change the monetary system of the world, and guess what? You can expect that there's going to be death around you and about you, above and below you, in big numbers, and you may be one of the people dying. So there's a common denominator, in my opinion. Do you know of another one, Melody, that's worth mentioning?
No.
What about Yvonne? He's on the phone. Think he knows of one?
We'll ask.
Yes.
Yvonne?
Good afternoon.
How are you doing? Good afternoon.
Yeah, pretty good so far. I had some heavy thunder poopers here, but otherwise survived it. Didn't get flooded out. But, I just want to make a couple of comments on what you talked about, Iraq, Libya, and so on. And I agree with you full-heartedly that the international banksters went after them. It was, we are using U.S. and other countries' armies to destroy and overthrow the government, change of the governments, because they were in a process of moving out from the petrodollar to gold standards or whatever other basket of currencies they were thinking of, and
they're just willing to take any currency, and what's actually happened, Iraq was, they took euros, they would have been happy, I think, to take rubles or Chinese yuan or whatever, they would have taken anything, and I don't know that they stopped taking dollars, but they were going to take other currencies as well, and once that started, it would cause enormous problems for the fiat dollar, and in fact, what has happened is the fiat dollar has lost something like 30% of its value on the U.S. dollar index since 2000, when Saddam started selling crude oil for currencies other than the dollar. Once he did it and got away with it, then other countries in the world began to follow. If we had pulled off that shock and awe thing where we bust in there and they threaten to sell their crude oil for currencies other than dollars, we gave them a shock and awe and finished them off, the whole world would tremble and say, oh my gosh, whatever you do, don't try to sell crude oil for anything but dollars.
Yeah.
But we didn't pull it off. We got caught, and it encouraged the world to say, I think we can work with currencies other than dollars too.
Well, you have a lot of combinations starting between China, Russia, and so on, as far as using their money to trade gas or whatever.
Yep.
And I understand even Japan and China has an agreement as far as using currencies, Asian currencies compared to dollars. So,
mm-hmm. That surprises me. That surprises me.
Yeah. It was,
because they are China being perhaps the largest economy in the world right now. There's reports it's exceeded the size of the gross domestic product of the United States. I don't know if that's true, but they're at least number two. Japan is number three.
Yeah.
That's pretty significant. So, plus, those two nations are not best buddies.
Well, yeah, but when it comes to the mullah, a lot of other things are kind of put in the closet. But anyway,
politics makes strange bedfellows, and money makes even stranger bedfellows. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah, and also, what is it that your enemy and my enemy and we are friends or whatever their saying goes, but since China and U.S. don't see eye to eye, of course, Japan is close to U.S., but if it comes to make negotiations with China and maybe collaboration with them, and they're seeing U.S. kind of, in the trillions and multi-trillions of dollars in debt and nothing to back up them, as far as the dollar is concerned, they may switch sides, So.
Everybody's on their own side. That's what it comes down to some degree. It's
absolutely.
Everyone is on their own side. And alliances are made and broken. They're temporary in nature.
Yeah, treaties are made to be broken. As far as I heard on CNN and also Fox reported briefly that the Iranian Revolutionary Guard crossed over to Iraq to support them as far as any further intrusion by the revolutionaries or who they were, what do you call them, the Sunnis or... But
who do you think they'll support?
Yeah. Well, of course, they'll support Shia. I mean,
I think that's right.
And the question I see, or potential problem in it, or not problem, but... possible plus for, let's say, Israel or someone like that is that they are at the doorsteps of Iran. Takfiris, or I don't know if they're Takfiris or whatever their religious beliefs are. And since they don't like Shia, and also they have, common borders between Iran and Iraq, they can slowly infiltrate into Iran and start causing problems as they are doing in Syria. So I just wondered if this whole thing is not being orchestrated in order to eliminate slowly the ties between, cut the ties between the various nations like Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, and so on, and slowly carve up or cut up the communications via land grab so that they can threaten any nation at any time if it comes to blows, okay?
I'm not sure who you mean, so they can threaten any nation at any time. Who do you mean by they?
Well, that Israel can use these terrorists.
I get what you're saying. Israel may be just stirring the pot in order to get these people to fight with each other. It's entirely possible, and it would be surprising if they weren't trying to do that. But the truth is there's a bunch of antagonism between the Sunnis and the Shiites, and I don't think you may be able to exploit it, but I don't think anybody can make it. it's already there.
You just stoke the fires,
My question on this is how did all of a sudden this all come about without any intelligence that this was brewing?
Exactly.
I mean, it's like it was just like all of a sudden it was like, and where did they get their strength? What, there wasn't any training to the Iraqi military at all these years? They just gave up their weapons and said, okay, I'm, this isn't worth fighting for. So, I mean, how did this all really get going so quick? And how have they had this impact?
One of the things that may have happened is the Shiites are in the majority right now. And the Shiites are running the country, at least with democratic principles. Because they're the majority, they can rule. I'll bet you that the Shiites themselves, even though they have a democracy, even though they're the majority, and they should be able to rule in Iraq, I'll bet they have mixed emotions about it because I suspect they understand that democracy is an ungodly form of government. If that's the case, they won't fight for that with the same enthusiasm. If the Sunnis think they're doing God's will to come back and try to take down a democracy, if that's what the Sunnis think, they're going to be hard to deal with. Right or wrong, if they believe they're doing God's will, they're coming. If the Shiites don't believe they're doing God's will, they're just doing, we're fighting for democracy, they're going to say, I don't know, this isn't worth it.
Well, democracy is a very loose defined theory, okay? I think democracy was probably in Greece, many moons ago, you know, when it was run by city-states. Yeah. And you could, in fact, one of the main speakers, and I'm trying to think of his name, Stavio C, but anyway, he said, democracy is as good as long as they can hear my voice. Once, you know, when it becomes too big, a democracy cannot really be a perfect democracy. Like here, if we didn't...
In other words, a representative democracy is... A representative democracy, which is what we actually have in this country, it's we elect people and then they get to vote for whatever they want. If they can con the majority into giving them positions of power, they become the real democracy. Democracy is Congress. And you and I are just, you know, along for the ride, kind of, but the democracy is there in the Congress.
Yeah. Well, I this is the whole point, that the people really, once they are elected, then you don't have a word. You know, they can do what at their wish. If they are paid by it and so on, they can do whatever they choose in order to...
And there are no principles you can count on. The only principle is whatever the majority votes for today is what we have today, and tomorrow they can vote for exactly the opposite, and the day after that they can vote for something at half the distance between the two. Whatever the majority votes for, there are no fundamental principles that we stand on that become part of our cultural heritage. It's just whoever can exert the most political power at any given moment. So it sounds odd, I'm sure, to the average people with some of the remarks I'm making about democracy being ungodly, but I understand this is a true story. This isn't just radical nonsense. This is a true story. The Muslims get it. Americans don't.
I agree that I think, you know, this is supposed to have been a republic, okay, the U.S., but I mean, that's beside the point. My point was about Iraq. You were talking about Balkanization by the people who control them. They did same thing with Yugoslavia, which was Balkanized, and you had like seven nations combined together, and it had to be ruled by a strong man. Okay,
of course it did, because they all hate each other. Because the coordinate nations or the subordinate nations all hate each other, and this is the same sort of thing we've seen in Yugoslavia. When Tito was there, he could push people around and lean on them hard enough and make them cooperate, and when he was gone, it was back to their same old cultural, you know, conflicts, clashes, and divisiveness.
I agree. That's what happened with Saddam, and also Melody mentioned with Gaddafi. Okay, they destroyed them. They start splitting up into their own tribal section or entities, and then or religious entities or whatever, and then it's uncontrollable. Now some nations do need what they call a benevolent dictator, even in Europe.
Yeah, I agree. Exactly. Some people get it, whether they need it or not, some get it. But, Yvonne, we've got to thank you for your call. We're going to take a break for some commercial announcements. Melody and I will be back in about 3 minutes. Please stay tuned, folks, to Financial Survival.
Denied internet access for their people during civil strife. The FCC seized in-use commercial shortwave frequencies right after the September 11th attacks. No one communication system can be depended on to be there when you need information. You need choices. You need a KU band free-to-air satellite system from AVR. The AVR system includes a receiver, an LNB, and a 75-centimeter dish. All you need to get on your own is the coaxial cable. The system is delivered to your door for $149.99. That's right, delivered for $149.99. That's the shipping and the system, $149.99. Call 541-225-4659. That's 541-225-4659. Or visit AmericanVoiceRadio.com and click Satellite System.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cederstrom on Financial Survival, and Frank has given us some new bumper music, which I kind of like. Kind of like the change, and it's kind of amusing. And I think this is music that Frank himself, if I understand correctly, Frank himself is the guy who's playing the musical instruments. Or is that right, Melody?
As long as we don't get bumped with new hosts.
Okay. We got an article here from Mike Shedlock's Global Economic Trend Analysis, and the headline is Average Cost of a New Home is 6 times the median income, historically 3. This is the headline. And what they're talking about is the average price of newly built home nationwide has reached $320,000, a 20% jump since 2012. That's a bunch. All right, that's a big jump in that period of time. It's actually since 2012 began, not since 2012. Since 2012 began, so it's actually since the end of 2011. That translates into, I don't know, 13% increase per year, thereabouts 15% since then. Pretty good return. That puts, or at least a pretty good increase in price for new homes. That puts a typical new home out of reach for 2/3 of Americans. Yet many builders have made a calculated bet. Better to sell a few new homes at higher prices than build more homes and charge less. Their calculation is partly a consequence of the growing wealth gap in the United States. Average inflation-adjusted income has declined 9% for the bottom 40% of households since 2011. Inflation-adjusted, you're down 9% if you're in the bottom 40% of this country. While incomes for the top 5% exceed where they were when the recession began that year, according to the Census Bureau. Buyers have historically paid about 15% more for a new home than for an existing home, a premium that's reached 40% today. Now, you're paying 40% more for a new home today than you would for a comparable home that someone else lived in for a while. That's a pretty big jump. And we can wonder whether that can be sustained. An average new home costs about 6 times the median household income. Historically, Americans have bought homes worth about 3 times their income. Understand that? In other words, there was historically, if you made $50,000 a year, you would typically buy a home that was worth 3 times your annual income, or $150,000 for your home. Today, if you make $50,000 a year and you buy a home, typically, what the implication is you're buying a $300,000 home. Even if you're paying twice as much for a new home as you did in terms of your income over past several decades. Construction has yet to rebound with vigor. Just 433,000 new homes were sold on an annualized basis in April. Over the previous half century, when the United States had a smaller population, annualized sales averaged about $660,000. That means sales are down about 50%. Sales of new homes are down roughly 50%. No, a third, excuse me, about a third compared to what they've been in the past. Now, point to all this, historical average for the price of homes was three times America's average income or median income. Again, if you made 50 grand a year, you could buy a house. You'd be expected to live in a house priced about $150,000. If that has, the question is that just an aberration? You know, is there a rule of thumb? Did it reflect a certain amount of common sense that was akin to a rule in economics? All right. Is this something that we can follow around the world? People tend to live in homes that on average are worth about three times the value of the people's annual income. If you make $10,000 a year, you live in a $30,000 house. If you make $50,000, you live in a $150,000. We don't know. I don't know whether that's a historical rule or not. But if it is, if this 3-to-1 ratio is going to be restored in the foreseeable future, then either the average man's wages must double or the price of new homes must fall by 50% as we return from our current 6-to-1 average house price to average income or median income to the 3-to-1 ratio that's been around historically. This may sound a little confusing, but where I'm going is I don't see any reason to suppose that average wages will double in the foreseeable future. I doubt that we'll even see any significant increase in average wages over the next decade. I don't think that's going to happen in this country. In fact, I'd bet the average income will continue to fall for perhaps most of the balance for the next 10 years. Now, if so, it follows that the only way the price of homes will fall from the 6-to-1 ratio to the 3-to-1 historical ratio will be by means of a 50% fall in the average price of homes. This conclusion suggests that while it's nice to live in your own home and sensible to buy a house as shelter, it's certainly risky and perhaps irrational to buy a home as an investment. All right? In some locations, homes will do great, prices will appreciate dramatically, profits will be made. Buy a house today for $300,000, in places you'll be able to sell it for $600,000 a few years from now. But in most locations, the house that you buy today will quite probably have a lower price if you want to sell it in the next few years. So the implication of all this, I mean, this isn't a proof. This is an evidence. It's not a proof, but it suggests that you got to think twice. If you want to buy a house as an investment, if you want to buy a house for shelter, great. But if you want to buy a house the way people did back in the late 1990s and early 2000s, when we're buying homes as investments, because you can't miss, because the price of homes always goes up, it's not a good investment choice at this time. It's certainly a risky investment choice and something you should be aware of.
Remember many times, Bob Chapman, you know, and I agree that homes are truly a depreciating asset because of all the money that you put into a home. Remember that old movie, The Money Pit, and certainly most homes aren't in that condition, but you do continue to throw money at your home by fixing it up and upgrading and replacing and the insurance costs involved and everything, all the other costs that are involved in a home. When you start tallying up those numbers, certainly the gains that you have. And it's interesting now I like real estate. I like looking at the numbers. I like to see what's on the market. I like to do comparisons. And you can go on to Zillow and they'll show what they think the real market value is compared to what the people are selling it for. And I mean, you have some extreme gaps between the two. And like, you ask yourself, are these people selling at the gap of the price, is it based on need or greed? Because I can't imagine if you need to sell your home, you would price it so high that nobody would want it at that price, and you'd strictly be greedy. And then my question is, what's the point of going through all the hassle of putting your home up? I don't think I wouldn't want to live in a home for shelter and view it as an investment. I would keep the two separate. But and of course, that's how many people got into trouble, as you mentioned earlier. So real estate market is a kind of a strange beast. You know,
it is right now because it's been overbuilt.
Yeah.
They still have, so far as I know, there are still hundreds of thousands of homes and maybe a million or more. I don't know what the numbers are. But there are a significant number of homes that are, they've been foreclosed. Nobody's living in them. They could
banks
go off the market on any given day. The banks are holding them in order to maintain the current price of housing. But how long can that be expected to, you know, to last? Sooner or later, the banks, you would think, are going to say, look, I got to sell these houses. I don't care what I get for them. I'm in a bind. I have to sell the houses. When they do, the housing market is coming down. The 3-to-1 ratio is there historically. We have a 6-to-1 ratio today. It implies that something's got to give. If that historical ratio has any, you know, if it's not just an oddity, but today there's actually a certain economic law behind it, a certain amount of common sense. You can expect we're headed back in that direction. And if we are, prices of homes have to drop significantly.
It's almost in the same way that the banks are holding the homes with the hope that a pickup in the economy and wages will get people to purchasing to where that they would be purchasing them. They just don't have to dump them on the market, that they'll actually have a market created where you'll have buyers. Very much like we talked yesterday about the Fed with all the stimulus and the stock market, hoping that the gaps come together, hoping that's not the stimulus that's holding up the stock market, but a true recovery in the economy and wages that will bridge the gap. And it's not happening there. It's not happening in the housing market. The housing market has been distorted, again, by these huge hedge funds that are going in there, buying up the buildings, a lot of these buildings, turning them into rentals. And the bad thing, Al, is we're a country that still doesn't have any affordable housing for
folks. We're going to. Well, they say here's the problem. What is going to happen to American wages? Can anyone look out in the future and say, listen, I think we're going to be making more money on average a year from now, 5 years from now? Anyone see any reason to believe that? It seems to me that it's just about certain that American wages on average are going to fall over the course of the next several years, maybe a decade. So what are we going to do about affordable housing? Are we going to all live with our mothers, you know, our parents, move back in with mom and dad? Or are the prices of homes going to come down so dramatically that those people who own them right now are going to take a significant loss in the price of those homes? You know, the other thing with the banks, insofar as they have homes that have been foreclosed, but they're not on the market, they're keeping them off the market. Homes deteriorate more rapidly when no one lives in them. You leave that house empty and it's going to fall apart. What's it going to be worth then? Decide to come back 5 years from now and see if you can sell it. And you're going to find out that the copper has been pulled out of the walls and the electric wires have been pulled out of the walls and the plumbing fixtures and the toilet and the rest of that are all gone. People sold them for, you know, $5 for a toilet and $1.50 for a shower fixture or whatever. They're going to be looted. So if the banks are thinking we'll just sit on them for a while and then we'll sell them and we'll get pretty good price, that's probably not a sensible strategy.
And, you know, a lot of this information we bring and we talk about, you know, it can be very gloomy and very doomy, but that's really not the reason why. I mean, when you know what's going to happen and how things could unfold, and maybe they will unfold, you get to do something about it. You get to make decisions, not only just buying gold and silver, but your next investment into your home or your next purchase of your shelter. I mean, this is all very important, how everything is all tied together, how it is all going to unfold, and what you see on the horizon. If you don't know the truth in all this, then you will go down with everyone else.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we don't mean to be all gloomy and doomy all the time, but there's a bright side. The bright side is you can do something. There is a silver lining. And, of course, we got a lot of silver here at Discount Gold and Silver. But, I mean, there is a silver lining, and there's something you can do about it. But you have to do it.
And you have to have the knowledge in the first place to recognize the problems. Exactly. I don't remember which word it is in the Chinese language, but I think it's danger. Or maybe it's crisis. And maybe it's crisis, emergency, I can't recall, but it's defined as that they use two characters to illustrate that concept, and the characters are danger and opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see difficult things here. And you see unpleasant things. Well, you can turn your head away and not look at them, not pay any attention, or you can learn from them. And you can consider what we've tried to tell you today, for example, about homes. And you can factor that into your decision as to whether or not you want to buy a new home, want to buy a used home, do you want to rent? And based on your decision, it may well be that the price of homes is going to drop significantly over the course of the next few years. Maybe you're better off to rent now and save as much as you possibly can. And think in terms of buying 3 years from now when there's high probability. Not a guarantee, but a high probability that the price of homes is down significantly. House you're looking at right now for $300,000, you might be able to get for $225,000 or maybe even $175,000. There's no telling how far these can go, but when you understand that there are fundamental forces that are pushing the prices down, well, you take that into consideration when you make your financial choices and your investment decisions. So in any case, it's all something you got to think about precisely because we're not living in happy times. Right, you've got to deal with the problems, but the problems are not just problems. They really are opportunities if you understand them correctly. I'm Alfred Adisk here with Melody Cederstrom on Financial Survival. We'll be back next Monday. Have a good weekend. God bless you, me,
Happy
Melody,
Father's
and the good Lord. Oh, excuse
Happy
me,
Father's
Frank,
Day.
The producer. Happy Father's Day. That's true.
Bye-bye.
All night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay.
Ain't it sad?
Still, there never seems to be a single penny left for me.